bottles all the way to the bathhouse. She found Jakin soaking in a tub, steam rising around him as a serving girl sluiced hot water over his head. His long hair, red on one side and white on the other, fell down across his shoulders, wet and heavy. She crept up, quiet as a shadow, but he opened his eyes all the same.
"She steals in on little mice feet, but a man hears," he said. "How could he hear me?" she wondered, and it seemed as if he'd heard that as well. "The scuff of leather on stone sings loud as war horns to a man with open ears. Clever girls go barefoot."
"I have a message." Arya eyed the serving girl uncertainly. When she did not seem likely to go away, she leaned in until her mouth was almost touching his ear.
"Wheeze,"
she whispered. Jakin Hagar closed his eyes again, floating languid, half asleep.
"Tell his lordship a man shall attend him at his leisure."
His hand moved suddenly, splashing hot water at her, and Arya had to leap back to keep from getting drenched. When she told Tuffleberry what Wheeze had said, the brewer cursed loudly.
"You tell Wheeze my lad's got duties to attend to, and you tell him he's a pux-ridden bastard too, and the Seven Hells will freeze over before he gets another horn of my ale. I'll have them barrels within the hour, or Lord Tywin will hear of it. See if he don't."
Wheeze cursed too when Arya brought back that message, even though she left out the pux-ridden bastard part. He fumed and threatened, but in the end he rounded up six men and sent them off grumbling to fetch the barrels down to the brewhouse. Supper that evening was a thin stew of barley, onion and carrots with a wedge of stale brown bread. One of the women had taken to sleeping in Weiss's bed, and she got a piece of ripe blue cheese as well and a wing off the capon that Weiss had spoken of that morning. He ate the rest himself, the grease running down in a shiny line through the boils that festered at the corner of his mouth. The bird was almost gone when he glanced up from his trencher and saw Arya staring.
"Weasel, come here."
A few mouthfuls of dark meat still clung to one thigh.
"He forgot, but now he's remembered,"
Arya thought. It made her feel bad for telling Jakin to kill him. She got off the bench and went to the head of the table.
"I saw you looking at me."
Wheeze wiped his fingers on the front of her shift. Then he grabbed her throat with one hand and slapped her with the other.
"What did I tell you?"
He slapped her again, backhand.
"Keep those eyes to yourself, or next time I'll spoon one out and feed it to my bitch."
A shove sent her stumbling to the floor. Her hem caught on a loose nail in the splintered wooden bench and ripped as she fell.
"You'll mend that before you sleep,"
Whis announced as he pulled the last bit of meat off the capon. When he was finished, he sucked his fingers noisily and threw the bones to his ugly, spotted dog.
"Whis,"
Arya whispered that night as she bent over the tear in her shift.
"Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling,"
she said, calling a name every time she pushed the bone needle through the undyed wall. "The Tickler and the Hound Sir Gregor, Sir Aimery, Sir Ilion, Sir Meron, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei." She wondered how much longer she would have to include Whis in her prayer, and drifted off to sleep, dreaming that on the morrow when she woke, he'd be dead. But it was the sharp toe of Whis's boot that woke her, as ever. The main strength of Lord Tywin's host would ride this day, he told them, as they broke their fast on oat cakes.
"Don't none of you be thinking how easy it'll be once my Lord of Lannister's gone," he warned. "The castle won't grow no smaller, I promise you that. Only now there'll be fewer hands to tend to it. You lot of sluggerbeds are going to learn what work is now. Yes, you are."
"Not from you." Arya picked at her oaten cake. Wheeze frowned at her as if he smelled her secret. Quickly, she dropped her gaze to her food and did not dare raise her eyes again. pale light filled the yard when Lord Tywin Lannister took his leave of Harrenhal. Arya watched from an arch window halfway up the Wailing Tower. His charger wore a blanket of enameled crimson scales and gilded crinet and chamfron, while Lord Tywin himself sported a thick ermine cloak. His brother, Sir Kevin, looked near as splendid. No less than 4 standard-bearers went before them, carrying huge crimson banners emblazoned with the golden lion. Behind the Lannisters came their great lords and captains. Their banners flared and flapped, a pageant of color, red ox and golden mountain, purple unicorn and bantam rooster, brindled boar and badger, a silver ferret and a juggler in motley, stars and sunbursts, peacocks and panther, chevron and dagger, black hood and blue beetle and green arrow. Last of all came Sir Gregor Clegane in his grey plate steel, astride a stallion as bad-tempered as his rider. Polliver rode beside him, with a black dog standard in his hand, and Gendry's horned helm on his head. He was a tall man, but he looked no more than a half-grown boy when he rode in his master's shadow. A shiver crept up Arya's spine as she watched them pass under the great iron portcullis of Harrenhal. Suddenly, she knew that she had made a terrible mistake. "I'm so stupid," she thought. "Wheeze did not matter, no more than Chiswick Head. These were the men who mattered, the ones she ought to have killed. Last night, she could have whispered any of them dead, if only she hadn't been so mad at Wheeze for hitting her and lying about the capon. Lord Tywin! Why didn't I say Lord Tywin?" Perhaps it was not too late to change her mind. Wheeze was not killed yet. If she could find Jaqen, tell him. Hurriedly, Arya ran down the twisting steps, her chores forgotten. She heard the rattle of chains as the portcullis was slowly lowered, its spikes sinking deep into the ground, and then another sound, a shriek of pain and fear. A dozen people got there before her, though none was coming any too close. Arya squirmed between them. Wheeze was sprawled across the cobbles, his throat a red ruin, eyes gaping sightlessly up at a bank of grey cloud. His ugly, spotted dog stood on his chest, lapping at the blood pulsing from his neck, and every so often ripping a mouthful of flesh out of the dead man's face. Finally, someone brought a crossbow and shot the spotted dog dead while she was worrying at one of Weiss's ears.
"Damnedest thing," she heard a man say. "He had that bitch dog since she was a pup."
"His place is cursed," the man with the crossbow said.
"It's Aaron's ghost, that's what it is," said Goodwife Amabel. "I'll not sleep here another night, I swear it."
Arya lifted her gaze from the dead man and his dead dog. Jaqen H'ghar was leaning up against the side of the Wailing Tower. When he saw her looking, he lifted a hand to his face and laid 2 fingers casually against his cheek. Catelyn. 2 days' ride from River Run, a scout spied them watering their horses beside a muddy stream. Catelyn had never been so glad to see the Twin Tower badge of House Frey. When she asked him to lead them to her uncle, he said,
"The Blackfish is gone west with the king, my lady. Martin Rivers commands the Outriders in his stead."
"I see." She had met Rivers at the Twins, a base-born son of Lord Walder Frey, half-brother to Sir Perrin. It did not surprise her to learn that Rob had struck at the heart of Lannister power. Clearly he had been contemplating just that when he sent her away to treat with Renly. "Where is Rivers now?"
"His camp is 2 hours' ride, my lady."
"Take us to him," she commanded. Bryeen helped her back into her saddle, and they set out at once.
"Have you come from Bitterbridge, my lady?"
the scout asked. No, she had not dared. With Renly dead, Catelyn had been uncertain of the reception she might receive from his young widow and her protectors. Instead, she had ridden through the heart of the war, through fertile riverlands turned to blackened desert by the fury of the Lannisters and each night her scouts brought back tales that made her ill. Lord Renly is slain, she added.
We hope that tale was some Lannister lie or...
Would that it were. My brother commands in Riverrun?
Yes, milady. His grace left Sir Edmure to hold Riverrun and guard his rear.
Guards grant him the strength to do so, Catelyn thought, and the wisdom as well. Is there word from Rob in the west?
You've not heard? The man seemed surprised. His grace won a great victory at Oxcross. Sir Stafford Lannister is dead, his host scattered.
Sir Wendell Manderley gave a whoop of pleasure, but Catelyn only nodded. Tomorrow's trials concerned her more than yesterday's triumphs. Martin Rivers had made his camp in the shell of a shattered holdfast, beside a roofless stable and 100 fresh graves. He went to one knee when Catelyn dismounted.
Well met, my lady. Your brother charges to keep an eye out for your party and escort you back to Riverrun in all haste should we come upon you.
Catelyn scarce liked the sound of that. Is it my father?
No, my lady. Lord Huster is unchanged.
Rivers was a ruddy man with scant resemblance to his half-brothers.
It's only that we feared you might chance upon Lannister scouts. Lord Tywin has left Harrenhal and marches west with all his power.
Rise, she told Rivers, frowning. Stannis Baratheon would soon be on the march as well. Guards help them all. How long until Lord Tywin is upon us?
3 days, perhaps more. It's hard to know. We have eyes out along all the roads, but it would be best not to linger.
Nor did they. Rivers broke his camp quickly and saddled up beside her, and they set off again, near 50 strong now, flying beneath the direwolf, the leaping trout, the twin towers. Her men wanted to hear more of Rob's victory at Oxcross, and Rivers obliged.
There's a singer come to Riverrun, calls himself Ryman the Rhymer. He's made a song of the fight. Doubtless you will hear it sung tonight, my lady. Wolf in the night, this Ryman calls it.
He went on to tell how the remnants of Sir Stafford's host had fallen back on Lannisport. Without siege engines, there was no way to storm Castle Rock. So the young wolf was paying the Lannisters back in kind for the devastation they'd inflicted on the Riverlands. Lords Carstark and Glover were raiding along the coast. Lady Mormont had captured thousands of cattle and was driving them back towards Riverrun, while the Great John had seized the gold mines at Castamere, Nunsdeep, and Pendrick Hills. Sir Wendell laughed.
Nothing's more like to bring a Lannister running than a threat to his gold.
How did the king ever take the tooth? Sir Perwin Frey asked his bastard brother. That's a hard, strong keep, and it commands the hill road.
He never took it. He slipped around it in the night. It said the direwolf showed him the way, that grey wind of his. The beast sniffed out a goat track that wound down a defile and up along beneath a ridge. A crooked and stony way, yet wide enough for men riding single file. The Lannisters in their watchtowers got not so much as a glimpse of them.
Rivers lowered his voice.
There's some say that after the battle, the king cut out Stafford Lannister's heart and fed it to the wolf.
I would not believe such tales, Catelyn said sharply. My son is no savage.
As you say, my lady, still it's no more than the beast deserved. That is no common wolf, that one. The Great John's been heard to say that the old guards of the north sent those dire wolves to your children.
Catelyn remembered the day when her boys had found the pups in the late summer snows. There had been 5, 3 male and 2 female, for the 5 true-born children of House Stark, and a 6th, white of fur and red of eye, for Ned's bastard son, Jon Snow. No common wolves, she thought. No, indeed. That night, as they made their camp, Brienne sought out her tent.
My lady, you are safely back among your own now, a day's ride from your brother's castle. Give me leave to go.
Catelyn should not have been surprised. The homely young woman had kept to herself all through their journey, spending most of her time with the horses, brushing out their coats and pulling stones from their shoes. She had helped Shad cook and clean game as well, and soon proved that she could hunt as well as any. Any task Catelyn asked her to turn her hand to, Brian had performed deftly and without complaint. And when she was spoken to, she answered politely, but never chattered, nor wept, nor laughed. She had ridden with them every day, and slept among them every night, without ever truly becoming one of them. It was the same when she was with Renly, Catelyn thought. At the feast, in the melee, even in Renly's pavilion with her brothers of the Rainbow Guard. There are walls around this one, higher than Winterfell's. If you left us, where would you go? Catelyn asked her. Back, Brian said, to Storm's End. Alone. It was not a question. The broad face was a pool of still water, giving no hint of what might live in the depths below. Yes. You mean to kill Stas? Brian closed her thick, calloused fingers around the hilt of her sword. The sword that had been his. I swore a vow. 3 times I swore. You heard me. I did, Catelyn admitted. The girl had kept the rainbow cloak when she discarded the rest of her blood-stained clothing, she knew. Brian's own things had been left behind during their flight, and she had been forced to clothe herself in odd bits of Sir Wendell's spare garb, since no one else in their party had garments large enough to fit her. Vows should be kept, I agree, but Stannis has a great host around him, and his own guards sworn to keep him safe. I'm not afraid of his guards. I'm as good as any of them. I should never have fled. Is that what troubles you, that some fool might call you craven? She sighed. Renly's death was no fault of yours. You served him valiantly, but when you seek to follow him into the earth, you serve no one. She stretched out a hand to give what comfort a touch could give. I know how hard it is. Brian shook off her hand. No one knows. You're wrong, Catelyn said sharply. Every morning when I wake, I remember that Ned is gone. I have no skill with swords, but that does not mean that I do not dream of riding to King's Landing and wrapping my hands around Cersei Lannister's white throat and squeezing until her face turns black. The beauty raised her eyes, the only part of her that was truly beautiful. If you dream that, why would you seek to hold me back? Is it because of what Stannis said at the parley? Was it? Catelyn glanced across the camp. 2 men were walking sentry, spears in hand. I was taught that good men must fight evil in this world, and Renly's death was evil beyond all doubt. Yet I was also taught that the guards make kings, not the swords of men. If Stannis is our rightful king, he's not. Robert was never the rightful king either. Even Renly said as much. Jaime Lannister murdered the rightful king after Robert killed his lawful heir on the Trident. Where were the guards then? The guards don't care about men, no more than kings care about peasants. A good king does care. Lord Renly, his grace, he would have been the best king, my lady. He was so good, he is gone, Brian, she said as gently as she could. Stannis and Joffrey remain, and so does my son.
You'd never make a peace with Stannis, would you? Bend the knee? You wouldn't.
I will tell you true, Brian. I do not know. My son may be a king, but I am no queen. Only a mother who would keep her children safe, however she could.
I'm not meant to be a mother. I need to fight.
Then fight, but for the living, not the dead. Renly's enemies are Rob's enemies as well.
Brian stared at the ground and shuffled her feet.
I do not know your son, my lady.
She looked up.
I could serve you if you would have me.
Catelyn was startled.
Why me?
The question seemed to trouble Brian.
You helped me in the pavilion when they thought that I had...
You were innocent.
Even so, you did not have to do that. You could have let them kill me. I was nothing to you.
Perhaps I did not want to be the only one who knew the dark truth of what had happened there, Catelyn thought. Bryeen, I have taken many well-born ladies into my service over the years, but never one like you. I am no battle commander. No, but you have courage. Not battle courage, perhaps, but, I don't know, a kind of woman's courage. And I think when the time comes, you will not try and hold me back. Promise me that you will not hold me back from Stannis. Catelyn could still hear Stannis saying that Rob's turn too would come in time. It was like a cold breath on the back of her neck. When the time comes, I will not hold you back. The tall girl knelt awkwardly, unsheathed Renly's long sword, and laid it at her feet. Then I'm yours, my lady. Your liegeman, or whatever you would have me be. I will shield your back and keep your counsel, and give my life for yours, if need be. I swear it by the old gods and the new. And I vow that you shall always have a place by my hearth, and meat and mead at my table, and pledge to ask no service of you that might bring you into dishonor. I swear it by the old gods and the new. Arise. As she clasped the other woman's hands between her own, Catelyn could not help but smile. How many times did I watch Ned accept a man's oath of service? She wondered what he would think if he could see her now. They forded the Red Fork late the next day, upstream of River Run, where the river made a wide loop and the waters grew muddy and shallow. The crossing was guarded by a mixed force of archers and pikemen wearing the eagle badge of the Malisters. When they saw Catelyn's banners, they emerged from behind their sharpened stakes and sent a man over from the far bank to lead her party across. "Slow and careful, like my lady," he warned as he took the bridle of her horse. "We've planted iron spikes under the water, you see, and there's caltrops scattered under them rocks there. It's the same on all the fords, by your brother's command." Edmure thinks to fight here? The realization gave her a queasy feeling in the bowels, but she held her tongue. Between the Red Fork and the Tumblestone, they joined a stream of small folk making for the safety of River Run. Some were driving animals before them, others pulling wains, but they made way as Catelyn rode past and cheered her with cries of "Tully!" or "Stark!" Half a mile from the castle, she passed through a large encampment where the scarlet banner of the Blackwoods waved above the Lord's tent. Lucas took his leave of her there to seek out his father, Lord Titus. The rest rode on. Catelyn spied a second camp strung out along the bank north of the Tumblestone, familiar standards flapping in the wind. Mark Piper's Dancing Maiden, Darry's Ploughman, the twining red and white snakes of the pages, they were all her father's bannermen, lords of the Trident. Most had left River Run before she had to defend their own lands. If they were here again, it could only mean that Edmure had called them back. "God save us, it's true. He means to offer battle to Lord Tywin." Something dark was dangling against the walls of River Run, Catelyn saw from a distance. When she rode close, she saw dead men hanging from the battlements, slumped at the ends of long ropes with hempen nooses tight around their necks, their faces swollen and black. The crows had been at them, but their crimson cloaks still showed bright against the sandstone walls. "They've hanged some Lannisters," Hal Mullen observed. "A pretty sight," Sir Wendell Manderley said cheerfully. "Our friends have begun without us," Perwin Frey jested. The others laughed, all but Bryeen, who gazed up at the row of bodies unblinking, and neither spoke nor smiled. "If they have slain the Kingslayer, then my daughters are dead as well." Catelyn spurred her horse to a canter. Hal Mullen and Robin Flint raced past at a gallop, hallooing to the gatehouse. The guards on the walls had doubtless spied her banner some time ago, for the portcullis was up as they approached. Edmure rode out from the castle to meet her, surrounded by three of her father's sworn men. Great-bellied Sir Desmond Grell, the master-at-arms, authorized Wayne, the steward, and Sir Robin Ryger, River Run's big, bald captain of guards. They were all three of an age with Lord Huster, men who had spent their lives in her father's service. Old men, Catelyn realized. Edmure wore a blue and red cloak over a tunic embroidered with silver fish. From the look of him, he had not shaved since she rode south. His beard was a fiery bush. Cat, it's good to have you safely back. When we heard of Renly's death, we feared for your life, and Lord Tywin is on the march as well. So I'm told. How fares our father?
One day he seems stronger, the next.
He shook his head.
He's asked for you. I did not know what to tell him.
I will go to him soon, she vowed. Has there been any word from Storm's End since Renly died? Or from Bitterbridge? No ravens came to men on the road, and Catelyn was anxious to know what had happened behind her.
Nothing from Bitterbridge. From Storm's End, three birds from the Castellan, Sir Courtney Penrose, all carrying the same plea. Stannis has him surrounded by land and sea. He offers his allegiance to whatsoever king will break the siege. He fears for the boy, he says. What boy would that be, do you know?
Edric Storm,
Brian told them.
Robert's bastard son.
Edmure looked at her curiously.
Stannis has sworn that the garrison might go free, unharmed, providing they yield the castle within the fortnight and deliver the boy into his hands. But Sir Courtney will not consent.
He risks all for a base-born boy whose blood is not even his own, Catelyn thought. Did you send him an answer? Edmure shook his head.
Why, when we have neither help nor hope to offer, and Stannis is no enemy of ours?
Sir Robin Ryger spoke.
My lady, can you tell us the manner of Lord Renly's death? The tales we've heard have been queer.
Cat, her brother said, some say you killed Renly. Others claim it was some southern woman.
His glance lingered on Brian.
My king was murdered, the girl said quietly, and not by Lady Catelyn. I swear it on my sword, by the gods old and new.
This is Brian of Tarth, the daughter of Lord Selwyn the Evenstar, who served in Renly's Raymo Guard, Catelyn told them. Brian, I am honored to acquaint you with my brother, Sir Edmure Tully, heir to Riverrun. His steward, authorized Wayne, Sir Robin Rygar, and Sir Desmond Grill.
Honored, said Sir Desmond.
The others echoed him. The girl flushed, embarrassed even at this commonplace courtesy. If Edmure thought her a curious sort of lady, at least he had the grace not to say so.
Brian was with Renly when he was killed, as was I, said Catelyn, but we had no part in his death.
She did not care to speak of the shadow here in the open, with men all around, so she waved a hand at the bodies. Who are these men you've hanged?
Edmure glanced up uncomfortably. They came with Sir Creus when he brought the Queen's answer to our peace offer.
Catelyn was shocked. You killed envoys?
False envoys, Edmure declared. They pledged me their peace and surrendered their weapons, so I allowed them freedom of the castle. And for 3 nights, they ate my meat and drank my mead while I talked with Sir Creus. On the fourth night, they tried to free the Kingslayer.
He pointed up.
That big brute killed 2 guards with naught but those ham hands of his, caught them by the throats and smashed their skulls together, while that skinny lad beside him was opening Lannister's cell with a bit of wire, guards curse him. The one on the end was some sort of damned mummer. He used my own voice to command that the river gate be open. The guardsmen swear to it. Inger and Delp and Lunglu, all three. If you ask me, the man sounded nothing like me, and yet the oafs were raising the portcullis all the same.
This was the imp's work, Catelyn suspected. It stank of the same sort of cunning he had displayed at the Eyrie. Once she would have named Tyrion the least dangerous of the Lannisters. Now she was not so certain.
How is it you caught them?
As it happened, I was not in the castle. I'd crossed the tumblestone to
You were whoring or wenching. Get on with the tale. Edmure's cheeks flamed as red as his beard.
It was the hour before dawn, and I was only then returning, when Longlu saw my boat and recognized me. He finally thought to wonder who was standing below, barking commands, and raised a cry.
Tell me the Kingslayer was retaken.
Yes, though not easily. Jamie got hold of a sword, slew Paul Pemford and Sir Desmond's squire, Miles, and wounded Delp so badly that Maester Wyman fears he'll soon die as well. It was a bloody mess. At the sound of steel, some of the other red cloaks rushed to join him, bare hand or no. I hang those beside the four who freed him, and threw the rest in the dungeons. Jamie, too. We'll have no more escapes from that one. He's down in the dark this time, chained hand and foot, and bolted to the wall.
And Cleos Frey?
He swears he knew naught of the plot. Who can say? The man is half Lannister, half Frey, an all liar. I put him in Jamie's old tower cell.
You say he brought terms?
If you can call them that. You'll like them no more than I did, I promise.
Can we hope for no help from the south, Lady Stark?
Asked Arthur Rides Wayne, her father Stuart.
This charge of incest, Lord Tywin does not suffer such slights lightly. He will seek to wash the stain from his daughter's name with the blood of her accuser. Lord Stannis must see that. He has no choice but to make common cause with us.
Stannis has made common cause with a power greater and darker. Let us speak of these matters later. Catelyn trotted over the drawbridge, putting the grisly row of dead Lannisters behind her. Her brother kept pace. As they rode out into the bustle of River Run's upper bailey, a naked toddler ran in front of the horses. Catelyn jerked her reins hard to avoid him, glancing about in dismay. Hundreds of small folk had been admitted to the castle and allowed to erect crude shelters against the walls. Their children were everywhere underfoot, and the yard teemed with their cows, sheep, and chickens. Who are all these folk?
My people, Edmure answered. They were afraid.
Only my sweet brother would crowd all these useless mouths into a castle that might soon be under siege. Catelyn knew that Edmure had a soft heart. Sometimes she thought his head was even softer. She loved him for it, yet still. Can Rob be reached by Raven?
He's in the field, my lady, Sir Desmond replied. The bird would have no way to find him.
Otherwise, Wayne coughed.
Before he left us, the young king instructed us to send you on to the twins upon your return, Lady Stark. He asked that you learn more of Lord Walder's daughters to help him select his bride when the time comes. We'll provide you with fresh mounts and provisions, her brother promised. You'll want to refresh yourself before.
I'll want to stay, Catelyn said, dismounting. She had no intention of leaving River Run and her dying father to pick Rob's wife for him. Rob wants me safe. I cannot fault him for that. But his pretext is growing threadbare.
Boy, she called, and an urchin from the stables ran out to take the reins of her horse. Edmure swung down from the saddle. He was a head taller than she was, but he would always be her little brother.
Cat, he said unhappily, Lord Tywin is coming.
He's making for the west to defend his own lands. If we close our gates and shelter behind the walls, we can watch him pass with safety.
This is Tully land, Edmure declared. If Tywin Lannister thinks to cross it unblooded, I mean to teach him a hard lesson.
The same lesson you taught his son?
Her brother could be as stubborn as River Rock when his pride was touched. But neither of them was likely to forget how Sir Jamie had cut Edmure's host to bloody pieces the last time he had offered battle.
We have nothing to gain and everything to lose by meeting Lord Tywin in the field, Catelyn said tactfully.
The yard is not the place to discuss my battle plans.
As you will, where shall we go? Her brother's face darkened. For a moment, she thought he was about to lose his temper with her, but finally he snapped,
The Godswood, if you will insist.
She followed him along a gallery to the Godswood Gate. Edmure's anger had always been a sulky, sullen thing. Catelyn was sorry she had wounded him, but the matter was too important for her to concern herself with his pride. When they were alone beneath the trees, Edmure turned to face her. "You do not have the strength to meet the Lannisters in the field," she said bluntly.
"When all my strength is marshaled, I should have 8,000 foot and 3,000 horse," Edmure said,
"which means Lord Tywin will have near twice your numbers."
"Rob's won his battles against worse odds," Edmure replied, "and I have a plan. You've forgotten Roose Bolton. Lord Tywin defeated him on the Green Fork, but failed to pursue. When Lord Tywin went to Harrenhal, Bolton took the Ruby Ford and the Crossroads. He has 10,000 men. I've sent word to Helmand Tallheart to join him with the garrison Rob left at the Twins."
"Edmure, Rob left those men to hold the Twins and make certain Lord Walder keeps faith with us."
"He has," Edmure said stubbornly. "The Freys fought bravely in the Whispering Wood, and also Stevron died at Oxcross, we hear. Sir Ryman and Blackwalder and the rest are with Rob in the west. Martin has been of great service scouting, and Sir Perwin helped see you safe to Renly. Gods be good, how much more can we ask of them? Rob's betrothed to one of Lord Walder's daughters, and Roose Bolton wed another, I hear. And haven't you taken two of his grandsons to be fostered at Winterfell?"
"A ward can easily become a hostage if need be." She had not known that Lord Stevron was dead, nor of Bolton's marriage.
"If we're two hostages to the good, all the more reason Lord Walder dare not play us false. Bolton needs Frey's men, and Sir Helmand's as well. I've commanded him to retake Harrenhal."
"That's like to be a bloody business."
"Yes, but once the castle falls, Lord Tywin will have no safe retreat. My own levies will defend the fords of Red Fork against his crossing. If he attacks across the river, he'll end as Rhaegar did when he tried to cross the Trident. If he holds back, he'll be caught between River Run and Harrenhal. And when Rob returns from the west, we can finish him for good and all."
Her brother's voice was full of brusque confidence, but Catelyn found herself wishing that Rob had not taken her uncle Brynden west with him. The Blackfish was a veteran of half a hundred battles. Edmure was a veteran of one, and that one lost.
"The plan's a good one," he concluded. "Lord Titus says so, and Lord Jonas as well. When did Blackwood and Bracken agree about anything that was not certain, I ask you?"
"Be that as it may." She was suddenly weary. Perhaps she was wrong to oppose him. Perhaps it was a splendid plan, and her misgivings only a woman's fears. She wished Ned were here, her Uncle Brynden, or... "Have you asked Father about this?"
"Father is in no state to weigh strategies. 2 days ago, he was making plans for your marriage to Brandon Stark. Go see him yourself if you do not believe me. This plan will work, Cat. You'll see."
"I hope so, Edmure. I truly do." She kissed him on the cheek to let him know she meant it, and went to find her father. Lord Hustertully was much as she had left him, abed, haggard, flesh pale and clammy. The room smelled of sickness, a cloying odour made up in equal parts of stale sweat and medicine. When she pulled back the drapes, her father gave a low moan, and his eyes fluttered open. He stared at her as if he could not comprehend who she was or what she wanted. "Father," she kissed him, "I am returned." He seemed to know her then.
"You've come,"
he whispered faintly, lips barely moving. "Yes," she said. "Rob sent me south, but I hurried back."
"South? Where? Is the area south, sweetling? I don't recall. Oh, dear heart, I was afraid.
Have you forgiven me, child?
Tears ran down his cheeks. You've done nothing that needs forgiveness, father. She stroked his limp white hair and felt his brow. The fever still burned him from within, despite all the maester's potions.
It was best,
her father whispered.
John's a good man, good, strong, kind. Take care of you, he will, and well born. Listen to me, you must. I'm your father, your wed when Cat does. Yes, you will.
He thinks I'm Lysa, Catelyn realized. God's be good, he talks as if we were not married yet. Her father's hands clutched at hers, fluttering like two frightened white birds.
That stripling, wretched boy, not speak that name to me. Your duty, your mother, she was...
Lord Hustle cried as a spasm of pain washed over him.
Oh, God, forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me. My medicine.
And then Maester Wyman was there, holding a cup to his lips. Lord Hustle sucked at the thick white potion as eagerly as a babe at the breast, and Catelyn could see peace settle over him once more. "You'll sleep now, my lady," the maester said when the cup was empty. The milk of the poppy had left a thick white film around her father's mouth. Maester Wyman wiped it away with a sleeve. Catelyn could watch no more. Hustle Tolly had been a strong man and proud. It hurt her to see him reduced to this. She went out to the terrace. The yard below was crowded with refugees and chaotic with their noises. But beyond the walls, the rivers flowed clean and pure and endless. Those are his rivers. And soon, he will return to them for his last voyage. Maester Wyman had followed her out. My lady, he said softly, I cannot keep the end at bay much longer. We ought to send a rider after his brother. Sir Brynden would wish to be here. Yes, Catelyn said, her voice thick with grief. And the Lady Lysa as well, perhaps? Lysa will not come. If you wrote her yourself, perhaps. I will put some words to paper, if that please you. She wondered who Lysa's wretched stripling had been. Some young squire or hedge knight, like as not. Though by the vehemence with which Lord Hustle had opposed him, he might have been a tradesman's son or base-born apprentice, even a singer. Lysa had always been too fond of singers. I must not blame her. John Aaron was 20 years older than our father, however noble. The tower her brother had set aside for her use was the very same that she and Lysa had shared as maids. It would feel good to sleep on a feather bed again, with a warm fire in the hearth. When she was rested, the world would seem less bleak. But outside her chambers, she found Uthryde's Wayne waiting with two women clad in grey, their faces cowled, save for their eyes. Catelyn knew at once why they were here.
Ned?
The sisters lowered their gaze. Uthryde said, Sir Cleos brought him from King's Landing, my lady. Take me to him, she commanded. They had laid him out on a trestle table and covered him with a banner, the white banner of House Stark, with its grey direwolf sigil. I would look on him, Catelyn said. Only the bones remain, my lady. I would look on him, she repeated. One of the silent sisters turned down the banner.
Bones, Catelyn thought. This is not Ned. This is not the man I loved, the father of my children.
His hands were clasped together over his chest. Skeletal fingers curled about the hilt of some longsword.
but they were not Ned's hands, so strong and full of life. They had dressed the bones in Ned's surcoat, the fine white velvet with the direwolf badge over the heart. But nothing remained of the warm flesh that had pillowed her head so many nights, the arms that had held her. The head had been rejoined to the body with fine silver wire, but one skull looks much like another, and in those empty hollows she found no trace of her lord's dark grey eyes, eyes that could be as soft as a fog or hard as stone. They gave his eyes to crows, she remembered. Catelyn turned away. That is not his sword. Ice was not returned to us, my lady, Othryze said. Only Lord Eddard's bones. I suppose I must thank the Queen for even that much. Thank the imp, my lady. It was his doing. One day, I will thank them all. I am grateful for your service, sisters, Catelyn said, but I must lay another task upon you. Lord Eddard was a Stark, and his bones must be laid to rest beneath Winterfell. They will make a statue of him, a stone likeness, that will sit in the dark with a direwolf at his feet and a sword across his knees. Make certain his sisters have fresh horses and aught else they need for the journey, she told Uthryze Wayne. Hal Mullen will escort them back to Winterfell. It is his place as captain of guards. She gazed down at the bones that were all that remained of her lord and love. Now leave me, all of you. I would be alone with Ned tonight. The women in grey bowed their heads. The Silent Sisters do not speak to the living, Catelyn remembered dully. But some say they can talk to the dead. And how she envied that.
Daenerys. The drapes kept out the dust and heat of the streets, but they could not keep out disappointment. Dany climbed inside wearily, glad for the refuge from the sea of Carthene eyes.
Make way!
Jogo shouted at the crowd from horseback, snapping his whip.
Make way! Make way for the Mother of Dragons!
Reclining on cool satin cushions, Zarozo and Daxus poured ruby-red wine into matched goblets of jade and gold, his hands sure and steady despite the sway of the palanquin.
I see a deep sadness written upon your face, my light of love.
He offered her a goblet.
Could it be the sadness of a lost dream?
A dream delayed, no more. Danny's tight silver collar was chafing against her throat. She unfastened it and flung it aside. The collar was set with an enchanted amethyst that Zorro swore would ward her against all poisons. The pureborn were notorious for offering poison wine to those they thought dangerous, but they had not given Danny so much as a cup of water. They never saw me for a queen, she thought bitterly. I was only an afternoon's amusement, a horse girl with a curious pet. Rhaegal hissed and dug sharp black claws into her bare shoulder as Dany stretched out a hand for the wine. Wincing, she shifted him to her other shoulder where he could claw her gown instead of her skin. She was garbed after the Carthene fashion. Zara had warned her that the enthroned would never listen to a Dothraki, so she had taken care to go before them in a flowing green samite with one breast bared, silver sandals on her feet, with a belt of black and white pearls about her waist. For all the help they offered, I could have gone naked. Perhaps I should have. She drank deep. Descendants of the ancient kings and queens of Carth, the Pureborn, commanded the Civil Guard and their fleet of ornate galleys that rule the straits between the seas. Daenerys Targaryen had wanted that fleet, or part of it, and some of their soldiers as well. She made the traditional sacrifice in the Temple of Memory, offered the traditional bribe to the Keeper of the Long List,
sent the traditional persimmon to the opener of the door, and finally received the traditional blue silk slippers summoning her to the Hall of a Thousand Thrones. The pureborn heard her pleas from the great wooden seats of their ancestors, rising in curved tiers from a marble floor to a high dome ceiling painted with scenes of Karth's vanished glory. The chairs were immense, fantastically carved, bright with goldwork and studded with amber, onyx, lapis, and jade, each one different from the others, and each striving to be the most fabulous. Yet the men who sat in them seemed so listless and world-weary that they might have been asleep. They listened, but they did not hear or care, she thought. They are milkmen indeed. They never meant to help me. They came because they were curious. They came because they were bored, and the dragon on my shoulder interested them more than I did.
Tell me the words of the pureborn,
prompted Zarozoan Daxus.
Tell me what they said to sadden the queen of my heart.
They said no. The wine tasted of pomegranates and hot summer days. They said it with great courtesy, to be sure, but under all the lovely words it was still no.
Did you flatter them?
Shamelessly.
Did you weep?
The blood of the dragon does not weep, she said testily. Zaro sighed.
You ought to have wept.
The Karthian wept often and easily. It was considered a mark of the civilized man.
The men we bought, what did they say?
Mathis said nothing. Wendello praised the way I spoke. The exquisite refused me with the rest, but he wept afterward.
Alas, that Karthian should be so faithless.
Zaro was not himself of the pureborn, but he had told her whom to bribe and how much to offer.
Weep, weep for the treachery of men.
Danny would sooner have wept for her gold. The bribe she tendered to Mathis Malarowan, Wendello Cardith, and Aegon Emerus, the exquisite, might have bought her a ship or hired a score of sellswords. Suppose I send Sir Jorat to demand the return of my gifts, she asked.
Suppose a sorrowful man came to my palace one night and killed you as you slept, said Zaro.
The sorrowful men were an ancient sacred guild of assassins, so named because they always whispered, I am so sorry, to their victims before they killed them. The Karthian were nothing if not polite.
It is wisely said that it is easier to milk the stone cow of Pharos than to wring gold from the pureborn.
Danny did not know where Pharos was, but it seemed to her that Karth was full of stone cows. The merchant princes, grown vastly rich off the trade between the seas, were divided into three jealous factions: the Ancient Guild of Spices, the Tourmaline Brotherhood, and the 13, to which Zaro belonged. Each vied with the others for dominance, and all three contended endlessly with the pureborn. And brooding over all were the warlocks, with their blue lips and dread powers, seldom seen but much feared. She would have been lost without Zaro. The gold that she had squandered to open the doors of the Hall of a Thousand Thrones was largely a product of the merchant's generosity and quick wits. As the rumor of living dragons had spread through the east, ever more seekers had come to learn if the tale was true, and Zarozoan Daxus saw to it that the great and the humble alike offered some token to the mother of dragons. The trickle he'd started soon swelled to a flood. Trader captains brought lace from Myr, chests of saffron from Yiti, amber and dragon glass out of Ashayi. Merchants offered bags of coin, silversmiths' rings and chains. Pipers piped for her, tumblers tumbled, and jugglers juggled, while dyers draped her in colors she had never known existed. A pair of Jogus Nai presented her with one of their striped zorses, black and white and fierce. A widow brought the dried corpse of her husband, covered with a crust of silvered leaves. Such remnants were believed to have great power, especially if the deceased had been a sorcerer, as this one had. And the Tourmaline Brotherhood pressed on her a crown wrought in the shape of a three-headed dragon. The coils were yellow gold, the wings silver, the heads carved from jade, ivory, and onyx. The crown was the only offering she'd kept. The rest she sold to gather the wealth she had wasted on the Pureborn. Zaro would have sold the crown too. The 13 would see that she had a much finer one, he swore. But Danny forbade it. Viserys sold my mother's crown, and men called him a beggar. I shall keep this one, so men will call me a queen. And so she did, though the weight of it made her neck ache. Yet, even crowned, I'm a beggar still, Danny thought. I have become the most splendid beggar in the world, but a beggar all the same. She hated it, as her brother must have. All those years running from city to city, one step ahead of the usurper's knives, pleading for help from archons and princes and magisters, buying our food with flattery. He must have known how they mocked him. Small wonder he turned so angry and bitter. In the end, it had driven him mad. It would do the same for me if I let it. Part of her would have liked nothing more than to lead her people back to Vaes Tolloro and make the dead city bloom. No, that is defeat. I have something Viserys never had. I have the dragons. The dragons are all the difference. She stroked Rhaegal. The green dragon closed his teeth around the meat of her hand and nipped hard. Outside, the great city murmured and thrummed and seethed, all its myriad voices blending into one low sound like the surge of the sea. "Make way, you milkmen, make way for the mother of dragons," Jogo cried, and the Carthene moved aside, though perhaps the oxen had more to do with that than his voice. Through the swaying draperies, Danny caught glimpses of him astride his grey stallion. From time to time, he gave one of the oxen a flick with the silver-handled whip she had given him. Aego guarded on her other side, while Ricardo rode behind the procession, watching the faces in the crowd for any sign of danger. Ser Jorah she had left behind today to guard her other dragons. The exile knight had been opposed to this folly from the start. He distrusts everyone, she reflected, and perhaps for good reason. As Danny lifted her goblet to drink, Rhaegal sniffed at the wine and drew his head back, hissing.
"Your dragon has a good nose."
Zaro wiped his lips.
"The wine is ordinary. It is said that across the Jade Sea, they make a golden vintage so fine that one sip makes all other wines taste like vinegar. Let us take my pleasure barge and go in search of it, you and I."
"The Arbor makes the best wine in the world," Danny declared. Lord Redwine had fought for her father against the usurper, she remembered, one of the few to remain true to the last. Will he fight for me as well? There was no way to be certain after so many years. "Come with me to the Arbor, Zaro, and you will have the finest vintages you ever tasted. But we'll need to go in a warship, not a pleasure barge."
"I have no warships. War is bad for trade. Many times I have told you, Zaro Zoandaxis is a man of peace."
Zaro Zoandaxis is a man of gold, she thought, and gold will buy me all the ships and swords I need. "I have not asked you to take up a sword, only to lend me your ships." He smiled modestly.
"Of trading ships I have a few, that is so. Who can say how many, eh? One may be sinking even now in some stormy corner of the summer sea. On the morrow, another will fall afoul of corsairs. The next day, one of my captains may look at the wealth in these hold and think, 'Oh, all this should belong to me.' Such are the perils of trade. Why, the longer we talk, the fewer ships I am likely to have. I grow poorer by the instant."
"Give me ships, and I will make you rich again."
"Marry me, bright light, and sail the ship of my heart. I cannot sleep at night for thinking of your beauty."
Danny smiled. Zaro's flowery protestations of passion amused her, but his manner was at odds with his words. While Ser Jorah had scarcely been able to keep his eyes from her bare breast when he'd helped her into the palanquin, Zaro hardly deigned to notice it, even in these close confines. And she had seen the beautiful boys who surrounded the merchant prince, flitting through his palace halls in wisps of silk. "You speak sweetly, Zaro, but under your words I hear another no."
The Iron Throne you speak of sounds monstrous cold and hard. I cannot bear the thought of jagged barbs cutting your sweet skin.
The jewels in Zaro's nose gave him the aspect of some strange, glittery bird. His long, elegant